Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The governor has hinted he plans to have the special session, but he hasn't fully committed to it, and we don't actually have dates.
Lawmakers have gone home, but a lot of state business still needs addressing. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage workers clear a homeless camp even with no shelter space to send people.
We're really uncomfortable with people having to move multiple times. People lose their stuff. It's hard to store their stuff.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAIN.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Anchorage municipal workers are taking the first concrete step this year toward clearing a sizable homeless encampment. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports that this push targets a public space that's holding a big outdoor music festival next month.
Anchorage Parks and Recreation employees in reflective vests are making their way around some city-owned properties in Midtown. One carries a staple gun, another carries a stack of notices warning that campsites in the area will be cleared in early June. They're posting them on trees.
Do you think people camped here at one point? That's why it's so dirty? Or?
I think it's because of the snow pile.
Just because of the snow pile, yeah. It's always dirt.
Dozens of tents are pitched in and around Cuddy Family Midtown Park, where volunteers and nonprofits come weekly with hot meals, medical services, and service referrals. The number of encampments here and at other public spaces around Anchorage have been growing since the city shut down its cold weather shelters on May 1st. City leaders are currently working on 2 separate policy proposals related to homeless encampments. One from the mayor's administration to clarify where, when, and how it will clear camps. The other, a community task force's recommendations the assembly will consider to legalize some specific sites for camping. Neither policy has been adopted, leaving campers uncertain how long they can stay put. Folks in and around Cuddy Park got a concrete answer on Wednesday.
June 6th is the date that we're targeting to begin the abatement.
Mike Braniff is the director of Anchorage Parks and Recreation. His crews will work with police to move people out and clean up what's left behind, though he says most people leave willingly. The process will be gradual, wrapping up on June 15th.
What we're doing is trying to allow ourselves enough time to have an orderly process with a relaxed feel rather than trying to get in and do this in 4 days or something like that, which creates kind of just a sense of rush, which isn't healthy for the overall, you know, for everybody involved in the abatement process.
The city's been reluctant to clear camps this year until policies are updated, and Braniff says no other large-scale abatements are planned at the moment. But Braniff says the upcoming Sundown Solstice Festival set this camp apart. The 3-day outdoor concert was permitted months ago. Thousands of people are expected to attend beginning June 16th.
The event is permitted for alcohol. And I think when we look at the large number of campers, and we consider both the unsheltered as well as the concert goers, and we just think about public safety in general, I think it's a unique situation.
City and outreach workers aren't telling displaced campers where to go. There isn't enough shelter space, and there are no sanctioned camping sites. Owen Hutchinson is a spokesperson for the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. He says there are consequences of displacing campers.
We're really uncomfortable with people having to move multiple times. People lose their stuff. It's hard to store their stuff. And it's really hard to maintain contact and trust with campers when they're constantly being moved.
Hutchinson says the coalition's weekly outreach events will continue, though the locations may change to meet campers where they are. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The Alaska legislature passed a budget last week, but many other bills that Alaskans and their legislators thought of as priorities didn't make it for a variety of reasons. Those bills aren't dead, though some might be even more difficult to pass next year ahead of legislative elections. The Anchorage Daily News had a rundown recently of the big bills that stalled out and might return in the future, reporting that the legislature only passed 30 bills last session. ADN reporter Iris Samuels says that's a way to gauge how effective or ineffective lawmakers were, and Samuels says one of the main disagreements is a familiar one.
The biggest one is the size of the permanent fund dividend, and that's been the question that has plagued legislative sessions for several years now, since 2016. And that's a broad disagreement, but it's really comes down to lawmakers' different approaches to state government. Some people think that state government should essentially just give people as much money as it can and not do much else. And some people think that government needs to do a lot of different things. And I think that the dividend crystallizes that question. So it's the question that everyone focuses on. But really, a lot of other questions are hiding behind that one issue.
Yeah, for sure. And part of what hung things up during the legislative session, the regular session, was this idea that we needed to increase school funding. How much should that be? And there were discussions about how big the PFD should be in regards to this school funding increase. So there was a school funding increase that passed, but it's not permanent. So this may come up again. It will come up again, probably. Can you tell me about that?
There are a lot of lawmakers that see this as a top issue, and there were a couple different bills introduced in both the House and Senate to achieve that goal of permanently increasing education funding. And there were discussions happening all throughout the session on this issue, but ultimately they couldn't get the bill across. But they did include this amount of funding, nearly $175 million worth of funding, in a one-time increase. And there is a bill that mirrors that amount that would be permanent. That bill passed the Senate but has not passed the House. So theoretically, the House could come back next year and pass that bill, and then the one-time increase we got this year will become permanent. Another option would be that the Senate comes back and they actually decide that they want a different bill that increases education funding even more, theoretically. And then that's something that, again, would have to pass both chambers.
Related to schools, but not on school funding, and this was a priority of our Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy, there was this parental rights bill. Can you remind me what that was and kind of what ended up happening with it?
Yeah, so this was a bill that the governor introduced a couple months after the session began. Governor Dunleavy says that this is a bill about parental rights, but really what it does is it focuses on sex education, and it limits the ability to teach any content that relates to sex education or to gender. So you can't teach anything that relates to that until third grade. And even after that, you have to get written parental permission. It would also have a few other components, like limiting the ability of transgender students to use bathrooms according to their preferred gender. So there was a huge backlash, and I think it's safe to say that this was the most controversial, or one of the most controversial, bills of the session. From the very beginning, we knew this wouldn't pass because the bipartisan majority in the Senate said from the get-go they would stay away from what they called social issues. They didn't even schedule the bill for a hearing. But in the House, it was scheduled for several hearings, and every time it was scheduled for a public hearing, there were hours of people calling in, and the vast majority of people that called in or testified in person were opposed to the bill.
There was another bill, and actually this kind of came out of some reporting that the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica did about the state not investigating complaints of discrimination against LGBTQ folks. There was a bill introduced to protect those folks. That also did not pass the legislature. Tell me about that one.
This is something that has been introduced in the past, but this year it got a lot more traction than it has in the past. So it passed two House committees, which was surprising because in order to pass those committees, it actually got some support from Republicans. And in the past, this was really just a non-starter issue for a lot of Republicans in the House. then it got to the House Judiciary Committee. That committee is stacked with some of the most conservative Republicans in the House. And their Republican, Sarah Vance from Homer, she refused to schedule it for a hearing, and that's where it stalled.
There were a couple different proposals for taxes this session that didn't make it through anything. I think the governor, you know, even sort of implied he was going to introduce a sales tax bill. We never saw that. But when this special session does happen to deal with a longer term fiscal plan, do you expect some of those tax bills to come up? And I guess what should people expect out of that?
Yeah, so Governor Dunleavy has indicated to lawmakers that he plans to bring them back for a special session, potentially in October, to talk about what's called the fiscal plan, the long-term plan to deal with the state's financial situation, the structural deficit, the fact that essentially the state has more costs than has revenue to cover them. So theoretically, anything that has to do with those issues could be brought up in the special session. It's worth mentioning that the governor has hinted he plans to have the special session, but he hasn't fully committed to it. And we don't actually have dates. There's no concrete plan. So we think this could happen, but it's not set in stone. And even if they are able to come together, which again would be at the governor's discretion, it's really unclear what they can agree on, because to the extent that we saw any action on bills related to taxes or revenue in the regular session, we just saw the same disagreements that have been a part of discussions in past legislative sessions.
Okay. Well, Iris, it's summertime. The prospect of a special session seem, you know, months away. Are you looking forward to a summer without having to think about the legislature?
I am. Last year was an election year, so this will be a nice break from that, an entire summer where we don't have to think about the legislature. But it is kind of looming on the horizon. If we don't have a solution to these big questions that the state faces, it means that a lot of people face uncertainty. So we'll continue to think about it, even if not every day.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Iris Samuels. You can read her full story about the bills that didn't make it out of the legislature last session, written with her colleague Sean McGuire at ADN.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska Native soldier gets recognition on Memorial Day, decades after his death.
80 years is really a long time for unfinished business. Private George Fox should have been recognized in 1944 after he was killed in action.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
A decision on the fate of a controversial road through Northwest and interior Alaska has been delayed for another 6 months. The Ambler Access Project, if completed, would span 211 miles west from the Dalton Highway to a mining region just south of the Brooks Range. It would cross through state and federal lands, as well as lands owned by two regional Native corporations, Doyon Limited and NANA. It also would pass through more than 10 miles of the gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. The proposed project is to gain access to the Ambler Mining District, a region with deposits of copper, zinc, and other strategic metals. Last week, the Bureau of Land Management filed a status report announcing a postponement of the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement and Record of Decision on the project until the middle of 2024. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, a state-funded corporation focused on infrastructure development, came out against the postponement. In a joint press release with Ambler Metals, ADA Executive Director Randy Ruaro called the delay frustrating. He said that it, quote, impacts individuals, communities, and the state who would like to see the economic benefits, end quote. ADA has not responded to requests for additional information. The initial final EIS for the Ambler Road was pushed through during the final days of the Trump administration, following several lawsuits challenging the permitting process, citing gaps in environmental analysis and public consultation. The Biden administration suspended the permits in February of 2022. The Anchorage Police Department and the union representing its officers have come to an agreement on a body-worn camera policy following months of negotiations. The tumultuous process has spanned three police chiefs and led to mounting community frustration and even a lawsuit over how long it has taken to get body cameras on officers. Voters approved a $1.8 million tax increase to purchase the cameras back in the spring of 2021. On Wednesday, the police department and the union announced they had finally come to an agreement on a body camera policy, which they had long remained at odds over. Union President Daryl Evans says the organization is happy with the policy and thinks it'll increase public trust.
I think we have some of the best trained and most professional officers, and I think that the fact that we're going to be wearing body-worn cameras will only continue to prove this.
Even with the agreement, the timeline for when the cameras will be on officers is still unknown. Police officials say they're finalizing a contract with the camera vendor. Once the contract is finished, officers will begin training on how to use the cameras. Juneau's greenhouse gas emissions have dropped by nearly 30% in the last decade. That's according to a new report that measures citywide energy use. That means they've reached a goal set back in 2011. But now it seems like maybe it's time to set new goals as experts urge the world to cut greenhouse gas emissions faster than ever before. KTOO's Anna Canny has more.
Greenhouse gas is everywhere. It comes from the fossil fuel that powers our homes, our cars. And in Juneau, it also powers mines and visiting cruise ships. It's everywhere. So there's no one way to get rid of it.
There really just aren't any silver bullets.
That's Steve Banky, Energy Chair for the Juneau Commission on Sustainability.
You really have to make these incremental gains on a whole bunch of different fronts. And then over time, they add up.
He's been working on local climate policy for years, promoting all kinds of carbon-cutting technology. Little things like LED lights, and bigger solutions like electric vehicles and heat pumps. A new report that added up all of the city's emissions from 2021 shows that those solutions are working. Total emissions are down nearly 30% from 2011.
It's good news. Reducing emissions is something that is a community value, and we're moving in the right direction.
That's Denise Koch. She's the city's deputy director of public works, and she's one of the people who contributed to the new report, which takes an inventory of local energy use and greenhouse gas emissions. Probably comes as no surprise that transportation and buildings are the biggest fossil fuel burners. Those sectors still rely heavily on oil and gas, but Juneau has cheap, renewable hydropower, so those are also the areas where the community can cut emissions pretty easily by introducing electric technology. And we already have. There are a lot more electric cars on the road since 2011, and thousands of electric heat pumps have been installed since then, too. But another thing the report highlights is that Juneau hasn't updated its emissions targets since it first adopted a climate adaptation plan almost 15 years ago. Back then, the city set a goal to cut 30% of emissions by 2032. And at the time, that felt ambitious. But today, it falls short of national and international standards. At the same time, federal money for cutting carbon and ramping up clean electricity is more readily available than ever. And having an idea of where local emissions come from can help the city to strategize and compete for that funding.
I see it as a foundational document. Once you know where your emissions are coming from, then you can make decisions and policy changes based on that information.
Now that the report is out, Banky and the rest of the Juneau Commission on Sustainability will put together a policy recommendation to present to the Assembly sometime this summer. One of the big ones might be setting that more aggressive emissions reduction target. But they'll also suggest doing more of these annual reports in the future. That way, Juneau can track its progress as the community continues to work on shrinking its carbon footprint over time. Reporting from Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Not yet a member of this station? Well, today is a perfect day to become one. You simply make a donation. It's that simple.
Invasive green crabs are in Alaska, and they're destructive, outcompeting native species and destroying essential eelgrass. At a workshop in Metlakatla last month, citizen scientists learned from experts how to look out for the invasive crabs in their own communities. KRBD's Reagan Miller has more.
Scientists and concerned Alaskans are at Tamgis Harbor. They're getting a firsthand look at the European green crab. And time is of the essence. The crabs showed up in southern southeast Alaska last summer, and more than 800 have been found since.
It's like we hit the ground running coming out here.
Taylor Stumpf is with the Wildlife Department of Metlakatla's tribe. He's helping people learn to identify, measure, and document the crabs. The workshop drew participants from around the region, including Ketchikan, Cake, and Prince of Wales Island. For now, Metlakatla is the only place in Alaska to document live green crabs, which are destroying vital eelgrass and habitat for abalone, clams, and Dungeness crabs. But that doesn't mean they won't spread. That's why the workshop, which was organized by local, state, federal, and tribal agencies, focused on training people to identify the crabs and alert authorities before it's too late to control the spread. People aren't allowed to kill the crabs themselves, but they are encouraged to collect information and alert authorities. That's what the workshop is teaching them to do. Stumpf explains a few key tells for a crab that doesn't belong.
They have the five spines on either side of the eyes and then the three bumps in the middle. So we've been teaching people with guides how to identify the crabs.
Ewa Booth is showing people how to set and bait different kinds of traps. She's an intern with Metlakatla's Wildlife Department. She says the tribe has been experimenting with what works best.
They usually like chum and herring fish. We haven't really used cat food like they suggested.
Booth says she's noticed a difference on the beach since the first crab was found last year.
Eelgrass is important because it's like habitat for other clams and like juvenile fish, juvenile salmon. So it was kind of a worry for us when they first arrived, and I've noticed that they've gotten a lot shorter too, like the eelgrass.
There's no surefire way to eradicate the crabs once they've arrived. But Janelle Winter, Metlakatla's invasive species coordinator, says the key is to just keep finding them. She says Metlakatla has always protected its resources, and that's what the town will keep doing.
It just sharpened everybody's need or awareness to protect those resources, right? Like, those resources were already super precious. It's wanting to make sure they stay intact.
Each female crab is capable of laying hundreds of eggs. In Metlakatla, green crab catching is a full day's work. Just ask Gabriel Nathan.
Yeah, we've been catching a lot when they were molting, when they're trying to hatch eggs and everything, and we caught like over probably 40 green crab with eggs still attached to them. And that slowed down a lot, so it was great.
The workshop's message is also one of hope. If everyone learns to spot these crabs, maybe there's a way to protect other communities. Trey Patterson with Metlakatla's Wildlife Department says that's the goal.
I think that the state or other places near us were taking it as seriously as we were. So to see something like this happening today here on the island, it's great to see that more people are taking this issue seriously.
Patterson says everyone has a stake in stopping the crabs and that things will get even worse if the crabs keep moving north. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Recognition for an Alaska Native soldier comes almost 80 years after he died in action in World War II. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, it's both a history lesson and the story of a forgotten soldier.
George Fox grew up in Unga, in what today is a ghost village in the Shumagin Islands in the Aleutian chain. Fewer than 200 people lived there when Fox signed up for the Army in 1941, just after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The last his family heard from him was in a letter to his father, dated May 17, 1944, sent from the front lines in Italy. The soldier did say he was finally seeing a little action, but downplayed the dangers and told his family not to worry. Instead, he asked about salmon prices and wrote, "I sure would like to be fishing again. This makes three seasons that I've missed." 2 weeks later, Fox died near Anzio Beach. Michael Livingston says he was part of a bloody campaign in which Allied forces lost 800 soldiers a day.
He was literally fighting the Nazis. A bomb exploded near him.
Livingston has spent a decade navigating government bureaucracies to have Private George Fox recognized for his service. He says Fox is one of the forgotten soldiers of World War II and the only Unangach, or Aleut, to die in that war. While working on a genealogical research project, Livingston discovered that Fox was buried in Italy, his remains later sent to Unalaska, where he was buried in an unmarked grave on a rocky hillside next to his mother. Livingston later located the spot, hidden by overgrown bushes, after he learned that a childhood friend of Fox's, Gertrude Svarny, had placed an American flag there every Memorial Day.
80 years is really a long time for unfinished business. Private George Fox should have been recognized in 1944 after he was killed in action.
As a fellow Unangan, Livingston says recognition is important in his culture, that traditionally warriors killed while defending their villages were elevated and honored with songs and dances. Livingston says he doesn't know for sure why the military overlooked Fox's service.
There's lots of different theories. One is the fog of war, the fog that had existed after war. George Fox was an Alaska Native soldier, and during World War II, it was fairly common for Alaska Native soldiers to be overlooked.
Last year in Unalaska, a headstone went up on Fox's grave, followed by a ceremony with full military honors. This year, efforts to acknowledge his service continue. His name has been added to a fallen soldier's memorial in Anchorage.
You can see at the very bottom here, PFC George Fox's name has been added. It was just added a few days ago. This is the first time since this wall was erected that a new name has been added.
For Fox's family, Livingston took some impressions of the engraving on the monument. He rubbed a black crayon against the paper.
It's just neat to see Private George Fox's name come through the rubbing.
Livingston calls it a metaphor that Fox's sacrifice, once forgotten, is finally coming into focus. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea, Wesley Early, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Anna Canny in Juneau, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby. Thanks to Lori Townsend for producing. I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.